So this is the second session that we're going to think and talk together about how we can support young people who have experienced sexual abuse or sexual assault. And there are slides to go along with us that you can find on our website. So have a look at those as you go. And we're going to be talking about the slides all together. So the first one that we've got is about what the research tells us. So it's super important to recognise that these are some of the things that are most important to think about when we are helping our children and young people navigate their way through their experiences. And the reason it's important to recognise this is because a lot of people are doing lots of these things already, but it doesn't feel like always like concrete things that we can kind of do, you know, but it's kind of like unsaid stuff that actually the research shows is the most important thing in supporting our children and young people.
Yeah, I mean, it's really likely that your child will feel some responsibility for what's happened to them, and it's really important for you to help them realise it wasn't their fault, that they're not to blame, and that might take the form of explaining that to them in detail to counteract any beliefs that the abuser might have helped to make them believe, if you like. And it's things like, you know, telling them that you're going to get through this together, giving them time to talking at their own pace, being very present. So I think it's really important not to underestimate all of those things that you're doing on a daily basis with your child and how powerful that is in terms of protecting them from, in terms of an indicator for their recovery, basically.
Yeah, I found it was very important for myself and my wife to explain quite clearly that all of her feelings, our daughter's feelings, were normal. There's nothing abnormal about the way she is feeling. Just to set her mind at rest, because she didn't understand what was happening at the beginning. And I think for us to just settle her and say, it's not your fault, what you're feeling is perfectly normal, and try to get them down to a calm level constantly.
Yeah, same was true of my daughter too. She felt that it was her fault that she'd put her dad in prison, dad being the abuser. So we had to constantly reassure her that, you know, she hadn't done anything wrong and this was nothing to do with her. The responsibility sat with him and fully with him. So, yeah.
I think it's really difficult for the young people and the children to understand and get their heads around why it's not their fault when this sort of issue is so cloaked in secrecy. So for our experience was very much in the school environment, being forced to keep things very quiet and understandably so for her protection as well as the other children. But it's a difficult thing to manage when you're asking them or expecting them to grasp that it's not their fault, they've done nothing wrong, but don't tell anyone. Don't let it out because consequences X, Y, Z, or there's an investigation or different things. So I think...
And that's perfectly correct, because they've been told, or she was told by her abuser, do not tell anyone. You must keep this a secret. So from you then start telling the child to don't tell anyone, keep it a secret to protect yourself. And so you need to explain it that this is for your protection. It's very complicated, very complicated. You just need to get to the level where they understand eventually.
I totally agree. And I think that it can often feel for young people that everything that happens afterwards happens because they told somebody. Mm. Because up until that point, perhaps nobody else knows and there's no other changes or ripple effects of things, but actually it's from the point from when they tell that everything then kind of unfolds, and that can very much feel like that's because they've told somebody, not because the abuser has abused them. And that's really important, I think, to highlight.
just coming back to that conversation about being with your child or your young person or whatever and helping them to understand it, we had to find a time that worked because she would invariably spill about 10:30 at night, which for us was really difficult to manage, really exhausting at the end of a very long day. And then she'd want to sit up for hours and hours and hours and talk. So we had to find a way to manage it. We would typically say, right, okay, this is when we're going to be really available. No TV, no nothing else going on. If you want to talk, it's a really great time. Or, you know, at bedtime or whenever it was for her, when she felt, you know, the need. And we also tried other things. So I know we had a worry jar. So for her, sometimes being really direct was a little bit much, or she didn't want to say out loud what she was feeling, but she was still feeling it. So she would write down her worry, put it in a jar, and then she'd either kind of slide the jar over or she'd bring it down and tip it out in a very dramatic fashion, depending on how she was feeling. Or she might just say, can we just go through it? And finding those times that is good for her, but also good for you as a parent.
And I think that highlights a really important point, that all of this is happening against the backdrop of everything else that continues to happen in life. So people still have jobs to go to, they still have other children to attend to, there's still appointments in school and all of that. So yes, we're kind of saying, you know, these are really important factors, believing our children, you know, letting them know that you're on their side, being ready to listen. But it doesn't mean that you have to be just purely available for that child every minute of every day, because you just can't do that, can you? And so also then getting the support for yourself so that you're able to kind of give as much as you can is also really useful too. So it's, yeah, that's a really good example.
Exactly. I was going to say the same. It's like you're really, it's a really lovely example because you're creating a space and your, you know, your availability is there, but you're actually creating space together, which also can feel boundaried and reassuring that, you know, that there is that space to talk.
But other parents have tried things like a worry monster, or going for a drive so you're not sat across a table, which can feel quite confrontational, or a diary that they would pass between themselves under the pillow, write something in, put it under mum's pillow, and then, you know, send it back when you've written in your response.
And I think we can talk about this a little bit more in a couple of slides ahead, but because there's, you know, not everything is going to work for every child in the same way. And a lot of it comes down to trial and error and just kind of working through it together. But I guess these things that we've highlighted here is the kind of backdrop to all of the other stuff that might be different, you know, for different families. If we approach it with this kind of set of this approach, really, that we believe you, that, you know, we're here for you, we're going to see you through it, that's a really good starting point. Shall we move on to the next slide? Okay, so the next slide we're going to look at is this idea of being a good enough parent. And I think this can be really useful because when something as significant as realising that our children have experienced sexual assault or sexual abuse occurs, we're not particularly well equipped necessarily, or we've never come across this before. It's not something on our kind of agenda. Like you said before, it's not something that's like openly talked about. It can be very hush hush and behind closed doors. And we can feel an immense pressure that we've got to get it right because our child has been through such a traumatic experience that we don't want to kind of compound that. And I think the overarching message is that there is no right or wrong way to do things. And that you may just need to be kind of working through things. And like you just said, there are times when something has worked that no longer works, or you have to adapt because young people are constantly changing, and you also might have to change things because we might have children that are very different ages. So something that's useful for a very young child isn't going to be appropriate for an older child, and vice versa. So it's not a static process. It's not a like straight line, basically, is probably what I'm saying, that there are going to be lots of kind of like bends and turns, and that's okay.
I think this for me was when the penny dropped. I think you you can't underestimate as a parent the amount of shame and guilt you feel for what feels like failing to protect your child. Like, rationally, you know that's not the case, but irrationally, that's what you struggle with. So this kind of idea of being good enough when what you really want to do is be perfect, better than perfect, because you want to fix everything and you want to make it all go away, and you can't. So that's understanding that psychologically and from the research point of view that you don't need to be 100% can be really comforting.
I think you raise a really good point as well, because actually what the research shows is that from very small babies, when we first have a baby the very first time and it cries, it can't tell us what the problem is. We're at that point having to work out what it is that the baby needs us to attend to. And the same kind of like thought can be, well, when there's something going on and we don't know how to respond to it because we've got no experience or practice, we are responding in different ways and working it out as we go until we land on something that might soothe a little bit that child at that particular time. But the research shows that actually when babies are very small, if we respond to their cues 30% of the time, that's absolutely sufficient and good enough to form a good, strong attachment and relationship with that caregiver.
Yeah, that 30% really threw me when I first found that out, because I strive to be as perfect as perfect dad as I could. And after a while, when I started to look at the evidence and science behind it, 30%, I thought that's very low. But that really helped to know that being perfect isn't impossible, and even being 50% is not necessarily achievable, but yeah, it certainly did help.
Absolutely, and I think what's really important within that as well is the consistency. So having a parent or a caregiver around who's consistently there, trying, present, trying to sometimes guess, sometimes getting it right, sometimes getting it wrong, but the mere fact of your consistent ability to try and interpret and to try and be there for your child is what's really powerful and important here.
I think as they get older, that rupture piece becomes a little bit easier, because you can speak to them and you can say, hey, I really didn't get that right, and I wanted to this is what I was going for, and it didn't quite work out that way. So it becomes a little bit easier as they get older. But it's quite hard to sit there and say and acknowledge that you didn't get it right. It's not an easy thing for a parent to do, because you're supposed to be this all-seeing, all-dancing, you know, eye that gets it right all of the time. And reality is you don't.
Yeah, and I think what was important for me is I felt like because the other parent was the perpetrator, it therefore meant that I had to get it completely right. And I did put a lot of pressure on myself to get it. I remember frequently saying, I'm not doing this right, I'm not getting it right, it's not good enough. So when I hit that 30%, it's like, oh, okay, well, maybe we are doing this then. And I think a lot of the things that were mentioned before in terms of communicating with your child, we tried. And I mean, there were times where she didn't have the words to talk about. She knew she needed to talk, but she didn't know how to or what to say. And so we did use the journal, and I would write in it. So if I was really cross with her as well, because there were times when I was cross, because there were times when, you know, she was being a typical teenager. And I would write it. So it was somehow easier for her to hear if it was written, and I would leave it outside her bedroom door. And then if I found it under my pillow, then I knew that she'd written me a reply. And somehow that worked. It didn't work all the time. And we did hint, and we said that, you know, what works in the morning of one day might not work in the afternoon of that same day. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I found also that sometimes just agreeing with them, not that sometimes your child isn't looking for answers, isn't looking for help per se, and just saying, yeah, that is shit, is all the child is wanting to hear, basically. So that sometimes is just enough. So don't try and fix everything all of the time.
Being heard and feeling validated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, modelling to our children that mistakes happen, people say the wrong things and do the wrong things sometimes, although we say there's no wrong thing, but, you know, unhelpful things sometimes. That's part of being a human and part of life. And actually, if we're kind of striving to be this perfect person for our children that never gets anything wrong, that's not a good message as well. You know, they won't learn the skills of, all right, well, you know, maybe that wasn't the best way for me to handle this situation, or I'm sorry that when I said that thing, I had to upset you. But the way that you repair from one of those ruptures has got so much value in it that you wouldn't get that without the kind of ruptures. There's a lot of learning and a lot of connection that can be done, and a lot of kind of opening up of conversations or other ways of kind of communicating by doing that.
Yeah, and I think when you're talking about communication as well, although you're effectively talking, or I was talking to a teenage child, at times I wasn't. I was talking to that child that had suffered the abuse. So she would present as maybe a toddler or five, you know, the age at which the abuse occurred. That was also something that I learned through coming to the education group. And actually that made a huge impact, because suddenly I'm like, I'm not talking to a teenager, I'm talking to a little girl who's really scared. And so you do need to adapt your language. And I think one of your previous slides, you mentioned about going with your instincts and actually believing your instinct, believing and going with it. And I felt like I had to do that a lot, because sometimes external family members would be, oh, well, you know, you're letting her get away with things, or, you know, you're not managing that behaviour very well. And it's like, well, actually, you know, it's pointless talking to her when she's like that, because you're not going to get anywhere. You need to just wait. So, yeah.
I think that's a really, you've highlighted such an important point as well, that is nobody's going to get everything right all of the time. But actually, as probably the closest caregiver to that young person, who else is going to have a better understanding of what might be most helpful for your child other than you, you know? And you may face kind of judgments and comments and all sorts from often well-intentioned people who love you, but perhaps don't understand it in the same way that you do. And I think having some of that, those messages that just kind of back you up in, you know, you're the expert in this situation, and to trust yourself. I mean, easier said than done.
Yeah, but it's like secret knowledge. It just makes you feel better if you're you know that what you're doing is right, because someone has said trust your instincts. It just makes you feel better.
And it's not kind of a rocket science, like, you know, educational kind of, you know, I've been through this training or I understand it. It's nothing to do with those kinds of things. You can get some useful bits of information, but this kind of, I believe you, I love you, I'm showing up for you, I'm listening to you, that's the skills, that's the kind of what you need. And you know, every parent has that in their loving relationship with their child.
I just wanted to acknowledge that is a massively heavy burden to carry for a parent. So, it, you know, we sit and we talk and it sounds easy, but it isn't easy. And I think you just need to take a breath and acknowledge that when you feel that fundamentally you've made the biggest error a parent can make because you missed it, that trusting your instinct as a parent is quite hard.
Yeah.
And when you're battling with the system, healthcare professionals and education system, the justice system, if that's the way that things have gone, that's not set up to allow you to trust your instincts. They want to put kids in a box and to follow a process. And, you know, we often talk about this being like grief, and you find that you know, you kind of are further along and then you're back, and it's very cyclical in terms of how the kind of the healing journey works. So I think it's just important to acknowledge that, yes, trust your instincts, and you know, you will be getting it right more than you think, but that's quite hard.
Yeah, I think that's that's where the greenhouse really helped, because speaking to other people that are in the similar situations to yourself and get validation that what you've done has also been followed by someone, that really is helpful.
Completely agree. It wasn't until I sat in the greenhouse that I actually felt I was in a place where people got it, or people got me, and I didn't have to fully explain myself.
And you can be yourself completely.
Precisely. And you pick up tips.
Yeah.
Pick up tips.
tips.
And you're exactly right. It was a heavy burden to take on yourself, and so seeking that support for yourself as well. And sometimes we can regain that internally, but other times we need a bit of external validation and kind of reassurance.
Yeah, and I have to say though, seeking support for yourself has actually been one of the hardest things to actually do, because whilst you're propelling your child through this journey, it's really difficult to find that support for yourself. And I mean, I'm not ashamed to admit, I nearly did go under, because I was the only parent and we had COVID thrown in for good measure. So we were all locked in a house together and there was no one else. So, and it was like, well, I don't know where I get support from. There's all this support that I can potentially access for my child, but not for me. And so we keep being told that the oxygen mask theory, isn't it? Put your own oxygen mask on first so that you can help your child. But actually, that's really hard to do when you can't find that support out there. So that is tricky. Really, I think, give yourself, I mean, and we were saying possibly earlier about hindsight's a wonderful thing, and actually looking back, it's much clearer when you look back and say, yeah, I really should have done that sooner, you know, but it's hard when you're in it.
I think being with other parents or caregivers that have been through what we have is, for the parent, the number one help tool you can have. Sitting with someone else who has been through what you've been through and not be judged and be able to say as much as you want, as little as you want, is the best source of help I think you can get. The Greenhouse have been brilliant with that, the drop-in sessions they offer. Yeah.
But I think it's interesting, isn't it? We all take different things from the material, the training, we've all had access to different services, we've all gone on different journeys, and little bits stick with you and not the same bits stick with everybody. So by the time you sit around the table and say, this was terrible today, somebody else has probably already been there or has gone, okay, that sounds quite similar. What about, have you tried? And it's just the tips that you might get.
Yeah. That it makes it worth the courage that you are going to need to get to that very first session, because it takes a lot to get over the door that very first time. And I think we all acknowledge that first time is the hardest. But once you've done that and you've met some parents who've been through similar, it's like, and I know for me, for being with parents who've been through the same thing, I finally felt like they got it. And I think I didn't know what to expect, I guess. And the fact that we do laugh as well, we've talked about that as well in the past. And it's sometimes you're like, oh, I shouldn't really be laughing because, you know, this situation is awful. But actually, the relief in doing that was immense. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, when our child is experiencing these big, big, big emotions and overwhelming feelings, I think for a lot of parents, I imagine the instinct is to do something, to take the pain away, to fix it, to make the problem. And actually, when we can't do that, it can be difficult to know what to do or where to go or how to help. And sometimes we can't, and we just have to be alongside them, and we have to be. And this is kind of where we think about like the empathy versus the sympathy kind of approach, that rather than kind of looking in on them and feeling sorry for them, you know, actually kind of putting yourself where they might be, which can be hard to imagine for lots of people, you know, but actually, what would I want if this was me in this situation? What would I want? And I think, you know, we don't need to have the solution, we don't have to fix it, we can't undo it, but we can be alongside somebody. I think it's really nice to kind of look at the difference between empathy and sympathy, as empathy drives connection, so it's showing our kind of understanding and our compassion for somebody else, and our ability to kind of understand where they're coming from and how they might be feeling. Whereas sympathy tends to drive disconnection. So you're kind of, it's more like a pity kind of thing, and it's a bit more judgy, and you're kind of like, oh, well, I feel really bad for you having that problem, but it's yours, not mine.
I think one of the things, the empathy is that, and I suppose it ties in with everything, is that my daughter was had reverted to being quite young. So suddenly I'd gone from having this 11-year-old who was very into teenage type things to a child that just wanted to be cuddled in watching a Disney movie. And I really struggled initially to wrap my head around that. But then it was like, well, actually, it's not hurting anyone, is it? Let's just sit and watch this. Let's cuddle in. Let's watch this film. And that's what she needed in that moment. And the other thing was her fatigue level. She was so tired in the days, sort of initially post-disclosure and post-completion of the police investigation. She was tired and she would sleep anywhere at any time. And so, I mean, looking back, I've got pictures of her asleep in the dog bed. You know, she would just cut up and she was almost body reversed. So she would sleep during the day anywhere and she would not sleep in her own bedroom. And it was learning to go with that and just let that happen. And we got through it. But it was like, that was weird because it's like, yeah, it's fine. Let's build a den in the middle of the lounge. You can sleep in there. That's absolutely fine. You know, so.
Yeah, similar to us. The acting like a toddler some of the times, just making noises and just really playing up really babyishly. We got to the stage where, talking of sleeping, she wouldn't sleep in her own bed,
yep,
because same. That is where some of the perpetration happened. And so what we had to do in the end, we couldn't move, we couldn't shift the house around, so we completely and utterly gutted her room from everything. New bed, new furniture, new... I just made it a completely different room. And eventually she started to settle in the room.
Yeah, we did exactly the same.
Yeah.
Totally just up like into
the
room.
A new room.
Yeah.
A new room.
I mean, we're fortunate enough to be able to do that. I think, yeah. You know, not every family might be able to do that. But changing things around might be enough. You know, just acknowledging that might be a difficult space, depending on what's happened, where it's happened. Just finding ways to make a fresh start, I suppose. But yeah. The fatigue is huge. I think for our daughter, because she was going to school 12, 13, being told, do not talk to anybody, and nobody at school knew apart from three people, she was masking the whole time. I mean, she got up and she went to school every day, which is phenomenal, but the cost was high. So there was a lot of fatigue. She would literally come home, have a meltdown and then sleep or for a couple of hours. And then, like you say, wake up, then wants to spill everything at like 10:30 at night. I'm done at this point. So yeah, it's just as a learning to go with that flow, and just that really useful piece of advice. I think we were really struggling early on to kind of with that, I need to fix this and I can't fix it. And it was sending us around the bend, and it's just acknowledging that it's rubbish and just sitting there and kind of going, yeah, it really is rubbish.
And empathise with them.
Yeah, but it's hard. It's hard. It's hard to do that. Definitely. Because your natural instinct is, yeah, I know it's rubbish. What are we going to do about it? And actually sitting in that moment, which is uncomfortable, but I think was a bit of a game changer. We noticed at that point, when you stop trying to fix it for them and just acknowledge it and sit with it, and then they kind of find their voice and they kind of guide you in terms of what they need.
What they want rather than what you can offer.
Mm. Yeah.
If you listen to your child, invariably they will tell you or they will signal. Not always in words, no.
No, I think sometimes as well, not feeling ultimately hurt when you're pushed away, because that happened a lot. You know, you're physically, you know, don't touch me, I don't want to be touched. And all you want to do is comfort that child. And so actually that's, and trying to take that personally is horrendous. That's hard. It's so hard. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you do just want to scoop them up, but it's recognising that, actually, no, I need to recognise when you need that distance. And I'm just leaving it.
I think that's what is the common thread amongst all of those examples, is that you're meeting your child where they are at.
Yeah.
And, you know, that these examples of, you know, what trying to sort of understand where they're at and wanting to sort of think about what you think that they should be doing or needing, but being able to, you know, take that step back psychologically and kind of go, actually, it's okay.
I think one thing as a parent you need to get your head around is your child's voice has been taken away, your child, their choices have been taken away at the moment or over the period of time that they were have been abused. And so the last thing your child will want is for you to take their choice away. So if they need to speak to you, even if it's 1 o'clock in the morning, speak to them, and then you can talk about when to speak, later dates. But it's always a child, get used to giving your child the choice and negotiate it from there. Don't be too put on them too much. This is what we're going to do. We must go here at this time. Let the child have a bit more choice, because that's what's been taken away.
Not an open-ended choice, though.
Obviously not.
As parents, that balance is really difficult to strike, you know, when they're playing, or what you perceive them to be is playing up or whatever. It's really difficult to strike that balance. It might be a choice between A or B. You know, what cereal do you want? Do you want cornflakes or do you want Rice Krispies? If you want to boil it down to sort of the basic level, not an open-ended choice, because invariably you'll get a response that says, I want all this to go away, or I want things to be like they were yesterday. And it's not in your gift to give that.
No.
So that element of choice, though, has been very, very important for our daughter's recovery in terms of, you know, meeting school and that kind of educational journey, in terms of what she wants people to know or not know. And when they've been silenced for so long, bringing it out into the light and then kind of going, oh no, but this is how we're going to do it. It's really difficult for them to get engaged. So I think listen, respect what they're saying, even when it's really, really uncomfortable or really hard. And then finding a way to meet as many of those requests or choices as is safe, is practical, and as you're able to manage, because you're not going to be able to do everything for them all of the time. And it'd be unreasonable to expect you to do that as parents. It's not reasonable. So it's how you find a way through it, rather than kind of being done to.
I think that's a really good point. And I think I liked your examples about the cereal choices, because there will be different choices that are possible at different ages. So like you say, for a young child, it might be, you know, they need to feel in control and have some choice in something. So it might be something a bit more straightforward about, you know, they only want to wear tracksuit bottoms from now on because that's what they feel safe and comfortable in. Fine, you know. And as they get older, I guess there might be more kind of possibilities. You might be able to have more communication with them about, I'd love to be able to give you the free rein to do whatever you wanted, but actually, you know, as a parent, I have responsibilities and stuff, you know. So it's going to be different at different times, depending on their kind of age and their stage. But I think, you know, if we look at the next slide, which is this example of an iceberg and kind of thinking about actually when what we see above the water is like the tip of the iceberg. And that's generally what we're kind of being presented with. So what behaviours we might see at home. So looking at the next slide is kind of thinking about that all behaviour is communicating something. And the like using the iceberg analogy of like, what you see above the surface of the water is what you're kind of being presented with, the behaviours you might see. But actually, looking below the surface, there could be all sorts going on that's driving that behaviour. And sometimes tuning in to really thinking about and considering what might be driving that behaviour, what's going on, can be really helpful. And again, it might be guesswork and we won't necessarily get it right all of the time, but it's looking beyond that kind of surface level stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say that I have found a real problem with school when it comes to that they will look at how she's behaving, but not necessarily attribute that to what's happened to her. So very often she would be punished, if you like, for walking out of a classroom. Whereas I was thinking, well, she's completely overstimulated. She needs somewhere to go where she can be safe. And that space not being provided in school is really quite tricky at times.
Yeah, I was just looking at that. It's the first time I've seen that slide, actually. And the first thing that sprung to my mind is very clear, but also it's very clear that what I looked at it was child sexual abuse is like it's not like an iceberg, because everything is below the surface and it hits all the crap underneath without you even realising it's happening. And it's just really important to know once disclosure's there, get on top of it as soon as you possibly can. Get on top of your support as soon as you can.
And I think it kind of, you know, like it links to the next slide that we're going to talk about alongside this one about having like a different kind of approach and a different framework. Like you said about the schools often respond to behaviour that perhaps is displaying something else going on. So, you know, what you might see is somebody becoming very dysregulated and they may want to get out and leave the class, or they might be disruptive in the class. And that's often met with like punitive approaches, or they're being difficult, or they're not concentrating. And actually, if we reframe how we're viewing a behaviour and think more what's going on beneath that, we will approach it differently. We'll see it from a different perspective.
I think that's where primary school have got the advantage, because they are much more used to dealing with children that can't articulate their feelings. So you typically get a lot less hassle with the behaviour at primary school. But when you move into secondary school, they've got a very, very, some schools have got an incredibly strict regime that is strict for any teenager. But when you've got a teenager or a young person who's had a traumatic experience, you know, I've lost count of the times when the school would say, well, can't she just, well, no, she can't just, you know, she can't just do anything actually, you know. And actually our experience with school was okay. But that whole kind of thing where, you know, some children are just treated as naughty. They're treated as naughty children when what they're actually doing is trying to say to you, hey, I'm not okay, or I'm struggling, or, you know, those behaviours that they display are really challenging. As parents, they're challenging to manage, you know. And I get that in a school environment, it's difficult when they've got to apply the rules fairly to all. So it's quite an inflexible system. Sometimes just having that adult that says, hey, you know, that wasn't ideal. What was that about? You know, and just asking the question.
And having some empathy.
Yeah,
with the child, yeah. Understanding that and understanding trauma-informed practice.
Yeah, I think the difficulty we had was that my daughter actually disclosed at school. So, and it was at primary school. And so then we had the transition to secondary school. And because it did go down a criminal route, there were children involved in the criminal case. So everybody at the school knew about it, but she always got into trouble for talking about it at school. And yet these children were in the case. So whilst the school always said to her, oh, she's telling people inappropriately, they already knew it was out there. It was already out there. And they didn't, school really didn't manage that, didn't know how to manage that at all, really. And I think my daughter always felt that everything was her fault. And actually school didn't help that. Their response just exacerbated that to the point we actually ended up not in school anymore.
As I'm listening to you, I'm just thinking about schools lacking time and resources and all the incredible pressures that schools and secondary schools in particular are under all the time. And we're asking people to look at this behaviour with a trauma-informed, putting glasses on and looking at it through a trauma-informed lens. But we also, as we're saying, that's not always possible. But I'm thinking, you know, to be able to adopt this approach, you need to have a sense of kind of curiosity in a way, to be looking at behaviour and being curious about what is this trying to communicate, taking a kind of a detective approach to understand what might be going on here. And that has to start at home. It might not always happen within the larger system and the community, but I also think that if a parent or caregiver is showing to a child that they're interested and curious and trying to understand what is being presented, then that's got to be a good start.
Totally, I agree. And I think that, and again, that's caveated with the, sometimes we won't always have our trauma-informed glasses on, we'll just be so bogged down in daily life that we forget to put them on and we miss something, or we misinterpret something, or we don't tune in. You know, that happens. But it's also, yeah, beyond school, beyond home, you know, this can kind of be used by anyone really that's interacting with the young person. You know, having that understanding or just even that curiosity to look beyond what you see about maybe why. And I think sometimes people, when people see these examples, actually it makes a lot of sense, but it doesn't necessarily occur to you in the moment that that's what might be going on. So, you know, you might have, well, they're not engaging or they're avoiding certain situations, and to other people who have not experienced trauma might not understand what that is and just think they're being difficult or we're offering you help and why aren't you taking it kind of thing. But actually, we know that that can often be masking kind of those, you know, not feeling safe in certain places, avoiding triggers, avoiding feelings of shame, you know, all of these things that might be happening underneath.
I think that links back to choice. So if you can engage your young person, I mean, for us, keeping her in school, it was a safe place that was not tainted with everything else that was going on. So for us, being able to manage that and give her choices and say, okay, hey, where do you feel safe sitting? And she did have a seating plan and she did have to sit in certain places. And there were different things that she had, like a leave the room card and, you know, regular check-ins. So school were actually pretty good. Did they get it right all the time? Absolutely not. When it went wrong, did it go wrong in spectacular fashion? Yes. But, you know, we acknowledge it, we move on. And I think it comes back to that whole rupture and repair thing. So it's the choice. You know, what can we do to help that child feel safe? That might be just acknowledging that they're not having a good day. As parents, if we know that something's going on, we can take that burden of communication and speak to the school and say, they're not having a good day today, or this is coming up and they're going to be a bit less engaged or tired, or no, they're not doing their homework this week because, you know, and there are different things that we can do to kind of make it a bit easier on them so that they don't have to carry that burden of everyone looking at them all of the time and saying, oh, aren't you, you know, you're an enigma to understand and pick at and dissect. And it's particularly if they're going through therapy as well. It's a lot of people, a lot of professionals. You know, you could have the police, social workers, therapists, teachers, parents, everybody wants a piece of this child or this young person. And that's, you know, what can we do to ease that pressure?
I think that's such an important point as well, because it's exactly about choice and it's about us tuning in a kind of thoughtful way, knowing that our child and what they need, because actually lots of children don't want to be viewed any differently. They feel like, well, this is my entire identity now that I've disclosed this thing, and all anybody's seeing in me is this experience that I've had, and all of these people are, you know, suddenly in my world and doing stuff, and I don't want everyone focused with their trauma lenses at me. You know, like there's
a balance.
Yeah, exactly. That's the word. It's intrusive, and it's not one thing fits all, and that's another thing that you don't know how to navigate until you have to try navigating it.
Well, no, and I think as a parent, it was about expectations, isn't it? So my expectation always had been, you go to school, you learn, you can't. And it was having to say, actually, the priority now is your emotional and your mental health. And that's where the priority lies. And actually, if education takes a back step or a back seat, then so be it. That's what needs to happen. And actually, until we start managing your emotional and mental health, we're not going to be able to access education. So for us, it was all for me, really. I mean, obviously, you have this child that you think is going to do really well at school, is going to get all these exams, is going to get really good grades. And all of a sudden, that's just completely turned on its head. And it's like, and I felt for me, it was about me managing. That was my expectation. And I had to step back and just say that, actually, we need to focus on your mental, sort of your mental health. And if being in school is not the right thing, then that's what we need to do. And so.
And I think somebody mentioned it being like grief before. And again, you're then having to grieve for this life that you kind of anticipated or hoped for your child, and perhaps they're grieving for this life that they hoped for, that is different now.
Yeah.
And that's a massive adjustment, as well as everything else that's going on. Yeah.
My daughter was just existing, really. I mean, we had suddenly a daughter who'd been quite proud of, like, she liked being quite fashionable, she quite bit of makeup, don't know where she got that from, it wasn't me, but suddenly was not showering, wasn't getting out of bed, wasn't kind of, I just had no, I mean, the amount of times I had to go out with her looking like she'd been dragged through a hedge backwards, which was embarrassing for me, but I had to manage that almost and just sort of like shovel that inside, because she just couldn't articulate what she was feeling. And it was like, it's better to have her out looking, however, than to be. So, yeah, we really struggled with motivation in the early days. She had absolutely nothing there. She had nothing left to give.
Yeah, so. Our daughter's motivation plummeted. And her self-care was non-existent, really. And that was a hard thing to get back on track.
It's not always back on track.
No.
We had, you know, the hygiene issues, the food hiding, various... I mean, teenagers' bedrooms are messy, right? That is not abnormal. But what we were finding was abnormal with the binge eating, the food control. I think she's just spiraling out, you know, and these were the things that she could control when she goes to sleep. So she would sleep when she wanted to sleep, not when we expected her to sleep. She would eat or not eat, as the case may be. And just a bit like your daughter, just no gumption to do anything for herself.
I think there's a really good example of like seeing a behaviour, noticing something and looking what is going on beneath that. And it could be like that. I need to have control over something, or I need to feel something in myself because I feel so shut down and low kind of thing that I need to feel something. It could be just I need to hide away because then I can avoid all these triggers or, you know, difficult, unsafe. But looking at the behaviour as communicating something more is really important.
But that's hindsight. Yeah. In the moment, when you find the three-month-old yogurt that is now everything has to be thrown in the bin because it's just... Do you know what I mean? It's those things where in the moment, as a parent, you lose it because you just think, oh, and it's now another thing that we have to deal with. And it's, I don't want people to think that we've got it all sorted because we haven't. Mm-hmm. And it takes a lot of self-reflection, I think, to work out after the fact quite often what you didn't get right or what you didn't see, or you called a behaviour and, you know, you thought you were parenting but didn't take the time to stop and think, actually... And when you've got two children in the house, that's really complicated because you've got different boundaries for different kids for different reasons. And it all becomes quite muddled, I suppose.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that completely. I think also you become the middleman for your child. I often find that I call myself the middleman because there are people that she doesn't want to see because their idea of managing things isn't her way of managing things, and it actually makes her worse. You know, her emotions will be heightened because she feels like she's always wrong or getting things wrong. So I have to act as that middleman and say, oh, it's okay, and try and explain to that person why my daughter doesn't want to see them. So deal with their hurt and anger, but also be there and say, well, no, I'm not going to put you in that situation because I don't want you to be re-triggered. I don't want you to be even more stressed than you currently are. So, yeah, I feel like I'm constantly a middleman.
Yeah, so there's a lot of things on that list that resonate with us as a parent. And
absolutely.
Some of it, again, you could read as normal teenage behaviour, but I think it goes deeper.
It is
the extreme versions of these behaviours. I mean, I have to say, we didn't see an awful lot of the aggressive behaviour at home, but I found out a week or two ago that she went through a phase of flipping tables at school. They didn't tell us that. That would have been useful. You know, she would often hide away in the toilet and ring me, even though she wasn't supposed to have her phone in school. She would. And you know, then I would have to contact the school and say, I don't know where she is, but you can have to go and find her. Well, can't she just come to reception? No, she can't just come to reception because she can't cope with any of it and she's now hiding. So it's those kind of things that you find yourself continually advocating for. And actually, I think sometimes schools maybe think we're a bit oversensitive.
Oh, yes.
A little bit crazy.
Frequently been labelled as an over-anxious mother. Yeah.
Yes. You almost become like the translator of the behaviour.
Yeah.
It's like another language, isn't it?
Yeah. Whilst I would agree, we haven't seen the aggressive behaviour either. However, I would have think that she turned that on herself. So we had a lot of self-harm and we had the control of eating as well. So I think that aggression almost was turned inwards. It was almost like disgust of herself. So I guess aggressive not outwardly, but certainly towards herself. Yeah, absolutely. And trying to manage that as a parent was horrendous. you know, having to do blade sweeps of a room and things like that is hard.
I think coming to the greenhouse, a lot of this information, we wouldn't have had a clue.
No.
Absolute no clue whatsoever, and we wouldn't be able to work our way through it.
No.
Doing the parenting course and then leading on to the parenting group.
Yeah.
That definitely has helped understand this, because this is not something a parent would ever think about knowing about.
No, exactly.
It just, I've never ever thought of trauma. I used to think trauma was bashing your leg or having a broken leg or something. But now I know trauma-informed practice, it's a lot easier to help your child. A lot more easier to, when you can...
It's complex, isn't it? I think the bit that blew my mind was understanding how physical the effects of trauma can be. And that's not something... I'd like to think we were reasonably well-informed, but not to the extent where you would get a physical symptom. Just didn't even cross my mind. So I think there's a lot of things that go on that you don't even make the connection with initially.
Okay, so having spoken about, you know, lots of those behaviours and what's going on and stuff, it can be really useful to understand what regulation is and how we learn to regulate. And basically self-regulation is how we kind of regulate and manage our emotions. And it's basically some skills that we learn through our lives. And when we're tiny, young babies, we have absolutely no skills and we can't regulate at all. And we need our caregiver to do that for us, to soothe us, really. And we're completely reliant on somebody else. But actually what that does is it slowly teaches us ways to kind of self-soothe and to regulate ourselves. And we do that like alongside somebody. So like as children grow up, they kind of, you know, they do it like sharing the kind of regulation with their parents. And that goes on into adulthood. And even as adults, we often need, you know, really distressing times or whatever. We need somebody to be alongside, connected to help us regulate ourselves. So it's really kind of important in order to be able to support your child. And it, when a child's experienced trauma, they're going to need more support with regulating themselves. So it might, like we talked about, kind of behaviours regressing a bit and going back to earlier stages. You know, there may be plenty of situations where previously they may have been perfectly able to regulate themselves in the situation, and now you're seeing them not able to do that at all, or they need a lot of support and help to kind of regulate themselves. So yeah, so it's particularly important after trauma. The other thing we were going to mention as well is how, well, it's important for us as people supporting young people to be regulated ourselves, because our energies feed off of each other, basically. So it's kind of like, I always think of that, you know, if you just go into a room and you can like feel there's a vibe or an atmosphere or something's tense, and nobody's said anything or done anything, but you could just, you get that energy from a room. And that's exactly how our bodies work, that we do. We have these mirror neurons in us that kind of like feed off of each other's energy system. So what that means, it can be really helpful and really unhelpful. You know, either we can both kind of get completely shut down or heightened, you know, in our kind of emotions, or we can support somebody to regulate themselves. If we're very regulated and we're very kind of steady, they may match our energy and it might help to kind of bring them to a better regulated state. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes complete sense. I mean, again, with the benefit of hindsight, I remember a situation whereby I think we were on a cruise, actually. I don't even know. But anyway, my daughter had a complete meltdown because she wasn't comfortable with the formal dress that she was having to wear for this particular dinner, and absolutely lost her. So she there was just no coming back from it. She just completely was so emotional. And in the end, it was lovely, actually. But again, it was hindsight. So she'd actually left. She'd removed herself from the family. She'd gone. She'd disappeared. But I'd kept an eye on her and I followed her out. still really, really crying. By this time now can't breathe because she's crying so hard. And so actually all we did, I didn't use the word mindfulness because if I use that word with her, she will not engage. But if I go, oh, let's just take some deep breaths, look at the horizon, I can see the horizon, can you see it? And sort of almost con her into taking some deep breaths. Then we were able to get her breathing back to kind of an appropriate rate so she could actually tell me what was wrong. And it's like, oh, okay, yeah, all right, that makes sense. Fine, go back and change. Put something on that you feel comfortable in and then come out when you feel ready. But again, I don't think it was all that calm and collected when I was in it. But looking back, that's exactly what happened. She was just completely dysregulated. There was no coming back from it. So
I cannot regulate with my daughter. Luckily, I have a wife who's excellent. So some people can and some people can't. Luckily, I think our daughter's come out the other side where she can regulate now. And she did that by learning music, musical instruments. That's how she does it. And that's what worked for her. So I think that's the end goal for regulation, is to get your young person to find something that works for them, get them on.
Yeah, I would agree. Music works for my daughter too, because she will put herself in an uncomfortable situation for the benefit of hearing the music or seeing the artist. But we've overcome, she doesn't give herself credit for the amount of stuff that she's had to put herself through to actually get that reward, if you like.
And I think you're exactly right. There's kind of different things will work for different people, and sometimes like somebody can be very flat and low and withdrawn, and they might need something that's like, I need to get up and go out for a walk or play really loud music that kind of brings your system back up a bit. And for others that are perhaps over kind of dysregulated and need to calm down, you know, there's all sorts of things. Like you're saying, it might be calming music, it might be the same, you know, listening to headphones, it might be having a bubble bath, it might be, you know, it's going to be different for different people. But
and I think as a parent who went through the criminal justice system and a parent who had to give evidence in a witness box, I absolutely had to draw on that to get myself through giving the evidence. Because if you'd have said to me, I don't know, however many years ago, you're going to stand in that witness box and you're going to be questioned by the prosecution and the defence, it'd have been like, yeah, right, no, that's not happening. But it wasn't a choice. It was kind of like, you have to do this. So I have never had so many trinkets about my person in order to try and get through that and to try and calm my heart rate, because my heart rate was like, I could hear it. Mm-hmm. I could hear it.
Feel it.
Yeah, and feel it. So it was, I needed that to get me through that process.
So we found with our daughter in school, that regulation, we put together a little tin. So she would keep that either in her bag or she had one at reception, and if she was panicking or worried, it would have things in it. She was really agitated, she needed to be physical, so she would need to run it off, or she had chewies, so you know, like get them off Amazon or wherever you shop, other shops are available. So chewy things, chewing gum, she had fidget toys, she had a Vicks inhaler, really stinky, can be nice stinky or bad stinky, it didn't really matter as long as it was strong. Just to kind of, she wasn't really very good at the breathing and the mindfulness. She would also really hate that. Yeah. But squishy toys.
Yeah, we had multiple.
Yeah, we still have squishy toys. So there's lots and lots of different things that we found that once we kind of moved back out of that needing to regulate her, we needed to find tools that she could use to regulate herself.
And I think those are all really, really good examples of how regulation is often really closely linked to sensory experiences. And as much as sensory experiences can trigger difficult emotions, they can also trigger really helpful kind of soothing emotions. So if you listen to the third session of this series, we're going to talk loads more about all the kind of how the senses kind of connect to kind of regulation and calm stuff as well. So there'll be a bit more about that in that session.
With regards to the box that you said your daughter put together, you can also pick up a copy of the Parents Guide, and it goes through all of that, what really helps.
We're now looking at the three R's, which is really related to what we spoke about in the first session of this, these kind of audio sessions. about kind of how the brain responds to trauma and what's going on in the brain in trauma. And now we're kind of thinking in terms of like, how can we support our kids and what approaches might we be able to take to help them? This model of the three R's can be really useful, because essentially it's in line with that Dan Siegel's hand model idea of them, you know, when the brain becomes really dysregulated because of sort of survival responses being triggered. And that's all the kind of stuff that we've talked about when kids are dysregulated or they're perhaps, you know, behaving in ways that feel out of control or unmanageable for them. The bit of our brain that's kind of dealing with all the reasoning stuff is completely checked out. It's not operating anymore. So actually, we say there's no rights and wrongs, and there aren't, but there is a useful kind of sequence of things that we can do that can be really helpful. So kind of while somebody's really dysregulated, don't get straight in with the reasoning is generally a good approach, because they just can't wrap their heads around that at that point. So kind of first of all, helping them to regulate, co-regulate. And again, like you guys have just said, there's a bit of trial and error about what's going to work for them and what's not going to work for them. And then kind of the next step is to kind of relate to them, so to connect to them in some way. And that doesn't necessarily mean give them a hug, although for lots of kids they'll like that. There'll be some that absolutely do not. It could be leaving a cup of tea outside their door, or, you know, sitting on the sofa next to them and not saying anything but just watching a TV program. You know, there are lots of kind of ways to just basically say, I'm here with you, without saying I'm here with you. And then kind of once they're in a more regulated state, that's when the kind of reasoning, talking if they can, if they want to, but the kind of more, what's going on and what do you need from me? That kind of comes then. So that sequence can be quite useful. So essentially, you know, if we keep the order of regulate, relate, then reason, that can be helpful.
I think this is the bit that in school is really difficult to manage. So we looked at the window of tolerance was the model that we were kind of working on. Makes me sound like I know what I'm talking about and I don't. But just that understanding that when they're dysregulated, their executive function, their logic brain is switched off. So they can't access any learning. They can't hear you when you say, please stop what you're doing, because it's not helpful. So it's just understanding that as a parent, I think sometimes you do need to just take a step back in a perfect world, you know, because sometimes we're also dysregulated by the behaviour, by the thing. Whatever is upsetting them can also be upsetting you. So it's, you know, just finding that space and not going straight in with the reasoning, which then turns to normally shouting and then consequences. And once you've committed, you're committed, aren't you? So it's not ideal, but understanding what you can do can make that young person, that child, just feel really safe. And
that, at the end of the day, making the child safe is the holy grail.
Yeah.
Is the holy grail.
And I think what you've just said there links really nicely to the next slide that we've got that demonstrates the different sides of the brain, so the left and the right side of the brain, and they kind of operate in different ways. And if you're kind of tuning in to understanding what side of the brain is dominating your child's behaviour when they're coming to you with something, and you can match and respond with the same side of your brain, that can often have a much more kind of connected kind of outcome. So, you know, we know that there's different sides of the brain do different things. So the left brain is kind of the logical, like you were saying, that executive function, the kind of more kind of thinking, linguistic, linear side of the brain, whereas the right brain is the kind of more emotional, non-verbal, intuitive. And it's kind of exactly kind of fits with that previous three R's model, really. It's a kind of a different kind of framework for it, but it's suggesting that if they come to you with their kind of right side of the brain that's very emotional and very non-verbal, and you're trying to then respond with your left side of the brain by, you know, let's talk this through with words and logic and reason, it just clashes and isn't always as helpful as if you can tune in and just be kind of alongside them.
I think that's so true, because I remember my daughter being really non-verbal. There was just nothing But she would sit down with a pencil and she would doodle and she would make marks with paint. And this is the whole regressing age thing, but it was like, I have never done so much art in my entire life. I am not arty. But she is, and she wanted to be. So that's where we had to go. And I suppose that it fits in a little bit with what we were just talking about in terms of musical and I'm using music because that ties into that right brain as well.
Yeah, definitely.
I think we tag teamed a lot. So depending on how she presented would depend which parent would be on deck. And I realise we're really fortunate that we have that system and not everybody does. But understanding yourself and how you respond to stuff is usually quite helpful as well, you know, because you will have a natural go-to left or right depending on how you are as a person. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be you as the parent doing everything all of the time. If you've got other trusted adults or siblings, or if they're older, or, you know, it's about that match and finding the right energy, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point as well, because it's also about kind of what we were talking about before, meeting the child where they're at, but not always having to be doing and just being. So if art, for example, is not your thing and you have no idea how to sit down with a pen and a paper, even just being alongside your daughter while she does it and doing nothing else and giving attention and whatever is good enough.
Yeah, showing your interest in whatever they're doing is a massive thing, even if you do find what they're doing very boring, very monotonous, it's not for you, it's for them. So yeah.
It's a connection again, isn't it?
Yeah.
Connecting with somebody by being alongside them, yep, doing something. So the last slide that we've got is kind of a model approach by somebody called Dan Hughes to kind of, is a general framework for ways to parent. And sometimes it's just useful to kind of be backed up or kind of know that there are general approaches that can be helpful. And I think particularly this two-handed parenting, where on the one hand you've kind of got the very warm, nurturing, kind of caring, connected kind of elements to being a parent. And on the other side, you've got that kind of boundaries and consequences and structure.
That's me.
And the other one.
And I think it's really, really difficult to get that kind of balance right any time for anybody, but particularly perhaps when your child has experienced trauma, is in a lot of pain and distress, and knowing, you know, it can be difficult to go one way or the other, and you know, and that's a hard thing to do. And sometimes, you know, some of those big feelings that come from these situations, like guilt or blame or shame and stuff, can make it very difficult to kind of parent from one of those hands. Or if you're somebody that's like, I just have to plow on and I need to keep the structure and the boundaries, it can be difficult to parent from the other hand, you know. So just kind of being aware that actually kids need both of those things, you know, they really do. But how much of each, I don't have the answer for, because there is no answer for that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the two hands and general day-to-day life, I think I would say I'm more to the right-hand side and my wife's more to the left. However, the two fingers that really resonate with me, which I think are, for me, the most helpful and important ones, is the structure. The structure for a child is really important. Even if they've been through something as terrible as what they have, a child needs structure. Otherwise,
helps them feel safe.
It helps them feel safe, yeah. Mm. And on the other side, I would say connection, because if you've got a connection, there's always a chance you can help and talk.
The challenge for me was very much around, how do you know what's trauma related and how do you know if they're just being teenagers?
Yeah.
And sometimes you get it wrong and sometimes you get it right. And as she's got older, it's been very much a conversation that is, I'm going to call it as I see it. And sometimes that means I'm going to get it wrong. And if I get it wrong, it's important to put your big boy pants on and go and apologise if you got it wrong, and acknowledge that it wasn't right. But that comes from a long, hard road of rupture, repair, getting it right, getting it wrong, and having that trust. And sometimes they are just being normal. And it, but the guilt, the parent guilt of you going, oh, but they've been through something really terrible. I must make it, you know, sometimes you're frightened to step into that role, which says, you know, I'm going to set this boundary. No, it's not okay for you to stay out till two in the morning, or it's not okay for you to throw your toy across the room, or, you know, it's not okay for you to do X, Y, Z, because, you know, it's striking that boundary is really hard as any parent. When you've got a young person or a child that's been through what they've been through, and you're kind of grappling with all those feelings of what did I miss, what did I do wrong, you know, kind of striking that balance is really difficult. So, you know, cut yourself some slack, mm-hmm. acknowledge it if you got it wrong. Even if they're small children, that's still really important, because you would hope that they would apologise if they upset somebody or hurt their feelings, even if they didn't intend to. I know as a parent I did, I would say, I know you didn't mean to do X, Y, Z, but little Billy's really sad about that. We don't like to make people feel, you know, mm-hmm. and so you would encourage them to acknowledge when they, so as adults, you've got to model that behaviour as well. Do we do it all the time? No.
And it's fluid, isn't it? Like, there'll be situations where you do need to make allowances or changes for things because that's too difficult. And there'll be other times when, no, you absolutely need to maintain things as a message to your child that the whole, what this, it's not all about this, and I still have high hopes for you and expectations for you, and, you know, normal life in quotes can go on and will go on, you know, and there's, you're constantly like navigating these shifts, aren't you? And then you've got other children in the mix perhaps who are going, well, how come they don't have to do that thing that I've got to do, and kind of navigating the ripple effect on the rest of the family. And then throw in the teenage years if you're at that stage, or throw in any kind of neurodiversities as well. Lots of those things, trauma, teenage years, neurodiversities, lots of these things can look the same. And trying to unpick what's what isn't always possible, but actually the general approach of we need all of these things, and we never in any given moment know quite which one they need right exactly at that time.
Yeah, and I think for me as a parent though as well, there are sometimes, I mean, I was consistently accused by professionals of not putting boundaries in place for my daughter. And I'm like, actually, sometimes I needed the boundaries not to be there for my own sanity. And I needed just to kind of just not deal with that today, because I didn't have the capacity to deal with it. So I think sometimes as well, the boundaries were not there for my sake rather than necessarily for my child, because actually I didn't have anything left that particular day to deal with it. And it was very much became a case of choose your battles. And I know we always say that, but actually it feels even more so now. It's like, well, in the grand scheme of things, does it really matter? Is she safe? Yes. Mm-hmm. Then no.
Well, that goes back to what we're talking about, regulation. Yeah. So it's regulating yourself. It's taking care.
Yeah.
Of your own mental health, so yep. that you're able to then provide that yeah. support
it's,
to her.
It's coming back to the fact that the child has got a much better chance of making their way through that healing journey if you as a parent are fit, you're well, you're as emotionally competent as you can be given what's yeah. happened, you know, and it's making those choices is really tough, especially when you're faced with criticism from everybody. Likes to judge everyone else. We all do it all of the time.
Yep.
Everybody, anybody that says they doesn't is lying, you know, but particularly with parenting, people can be very openly judgy. Especially if they know that you've got a child that's been through something or has a medical condition, or, you know, it feels like it's open season to say what you want to say. So you're kind of battling with that. What I need to be able to function today, tomorrow, and what everybody else expects I should be doing as a parent and expects my child to be doing today at any given moment.
Yeah.
And it comes back to you being the experts of your experiences and your families. And it doesn't mean you always get it right, but you know better than anyone else your child.
I think all parents know their children, and it is, if you've got no idea what to do, which invariably you won't, just reach out to other parents if you need to. That is the biggest part, biggest bit of help I can suggest. Reach out to other parents.
And I think the final bit that we've got on this slide, which is the PACE model of Dan Hughes, it basically comes full circle to what we talked about at the beginning, those what does the research tell us, and it's a general approach of like, actually, we've spoken about this all the way through our conversation today, particularly the kind of acceptance, the curiosity, seeing it through trauma-informed lens, what's going on behind it, really wanting to know, you know, being alongside our children with empathy. But I think actually playfulness, and I you mentioned it earlier in the beginning, just saying actually it's okay to have a laugh as well. Like, and that doesn't undermine the seriousness of this. But children are children, and they also are able and want to have joy in their lives, and that's okay. You we know, always and embrace that.
We always joke that this is a club that you'd never want to be a member of, but actually, thank God it's here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this conversation today has been between some of the staff at the Greenhouse and some of the parents who have access services at the Greenhouse, or whose young people have access. Thank you so much for listening. We're really glad that you are. We'd also possibly love to see you in person if you live in the Bristol, South Gloss, North Somerset or Bath and North East Somerset areas, if that feels right for you. For any more information, we've got tons of stuff on our website, so head to www.the-green-house.org.uk for further info about our services and other services. And if you are kind of worried about yourself or your child, please see your GP or think about contacting your local CAM service. Thanks again for listening, and also have a listen to some of the other conversations we've had.